Unconventional Life, the show where twice a week I interview successful entrepreneurs, artists, creatives, and thought leaders on how they earn their living in non-traditional ways. Each of these individuals are at the top of their game in terms of revenue and reach in their respective industry, living life in the driver's seat beyond what is traditional or predictable. On this show, you will learn how they took the path less traveled, what their revenue model looks like, and why they are prioritizing their passion over their paycheck.
It means living a life of passion and purpose.
And what would it look like if you create it from the ground up?
Everything that's shown up in my business has been a place for me to grow or expand as a human being.
I pretty much get paid to be me.
Very frequently, the exact things you think are against you might be the things that are actually the reason you can make it.
I'm your host, Jewel Schroeder.
If you would like to win this week's prize giveaway from our show guests featuring free access to their online courses, books, and other impactful tools to help you on the path to living an unconventional life, simply subscribe to the podcast on iTunes now and go to unconventionallifeshow.com to let us know you did. You can also get a second entry by leaving us an iTunes review.
Unconventional Life, welcome. This is your host, Jewel Schroeder, tuning in from hometown Boulder, Colorado today. I've got a very special guest joining us from London, England. I've got Raquel Vasquez on the line. Raquel, are you ready to take us down the path less traveled?
I guess so. Let's go for it.
Amazing. So Raquel is on this year's 30 Under 30 list in law and policy. She works in the intersection of public policy, law, and technology to ensure that relevant digital evidence on atrocity crimes is used by the appropriate investigative and judicial bodies. So what Raquel is doing is super cool with her company, Eyewitness to Atrocities. Essentially, this company is changing the rules of how video and photo evidence is used so that you literally can take out your phone or log into their app. And if you're witnessing a crime, being able to verify the material you're witnessing and being able to authenticate that material. So Raquel's story is amazing. She's worked in war zones and over 15 different countries, and super happy to have her on the show. So with that being said, Raquel, welcome to Unconventional Life. Go ahead and fill in any details I might have left out and share a little bit about your personal life.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. This is a great opportunity because legal professionals generally don't tend to do many podcasts about their unconventional lives. They tend to be way more conventional. And at least, well, the only reason why I know that perhaps mine was an unconventional career path is because my friends always ask me, so what do you really do for a living? So I'm very happy to be here today because at least this time I have your podcast and I say, just listen to Jules' podcast and you'll understand more. Because I try to give them the speech, but it doesn't really, they keep asking me, so you get to the office and what do you do every morning? So I think this is a great opportunity. So thank you very much. Where would you like me to get started?
Yeah, well, so I know your story is fascinating. So you grew up, you know, in northern Spain. You moved to Madrid when you were 17. From there, you studied in France. You've been to different countries like Israel, and you've studied in Singapore. And so you've been internationally all over the place. So let's just start, you know, with what exactly do you do? Because I know you're a lawyer, first and foremost. But how does a lawyer end up in all of these different countries and working on something, you know, dedicated into this type of war policy?
Well, I always say, kind of excusing myself, that I'm a little bit of a fake lawyer because I am qualified, and it took me a long time to qualify. I studied 6 years in Spain. That it was like, back then it was what it used to take you to qualify. And I did my studies law and business, so it was longer studies. So 6 years was enough for me. And I really started traveling before I even finished my studies. I decided that I really wanted to get on-the-ground experience. So even before finishing my studies, I decided to move to Israel, and initially it was only for 3 months. And I did it because I had the support of my professors, and they saw that I really wanted to get an experience in international law, and my university wasn't particularly strong on that. So I think I emailed pretty much every organization in Israel. Until one that happened to be the biggest and oldest one replied to me and said, okay, can you do legal research? And I said, of course I can. and I went there for 3 months, and I found the country and the context fascinating, not only from a legal point of view, but all the things that are going on all the time, and the different cultures that merge, for example, in a city like Jerusalem. So I decided to stay for longer, and I stayed almost for a year at the end. And I keep coming back every year for another reason or a reason or another. And yeah, like it's quite fun if you look at it, because I come from a pretty small place in the north of Spain. I come from the Basque Country. So it's true that I think because of that background, I've been always interested in violence, because I grew up in the 90s, in the worst years of terrorism in the Basque Country. So I was always very curious of what drives people to violence. And I think then this combined with my legal studies kind of ended up putting me on the path of more of international criminal law or international law in armed conflict. So that's very in a nutshell how everything started, I guess.
Yeah, totally. So, mm-hmm. you know, you like you said, you grew up in northern Spain. What had you decide mm-hmm. you wanted to pursue law? Was it that fascination that you had growing up in the 90s around this terrorist mm-hmm. environment? Did you know you were going to go specifically into type of international law, or how did that come about?
To be honest, I think I was 17. My dad is a lawyer, and I didn't give it too much thought, as bad as it sounds. I thought just that doing law wasn't enough, so I decided to do double studies and do business. So, yeah, it's very weird that someone has done law and business and then end up doing also human rights. So it was more, I was a little bit lost, and generally in Spain, like law is a quite common career path. So I was, yeah, I'll just do this and then figure it out. And I didn't even think much about the university I wanted to go to be honest, I think. But I had very good grades in high school, so I got to a very good university. And I think that kind of saved me, because it exposed me to people from very different backgrounds. It exposed me to very different ideas. My university is quite left-wing, so it's where I started to see different approaches to also human rights and international justice. But it's true that I think there was also already something inside me, because I remember when I was a kid, like I must have been like 13 years old, that I show up at the local chapter of Amnesty International in my home city, and they pretty much send me home and say, like, you are 12 or 13, like, how are you even here? I don't think my parents even know that I show up there. So I think I always had in me a little bit, like, at least that rebellion side of, like, or of activism, or, like, of just being an upset person. So... And so, yeah, like going to the point of your question, I guess, where I decided to study law just because it was something that it seemed like I could do a lot of things with it. And I didn't have it clear when I was 17. So I was, well, I'll just figure it out later. And I guess I did.
Yeah, totally. You know, and I like you're highlighting these few things based when you're, you know, 13 years old, having this like brewing passion and curiosity developing, but not quite sure like the outlet for it. And then you getting there and them sending you home. And so at what point was it like the turning point where your path was generally pretty predictable? You know, you're going down this law career. Like you said, a lot of people in Spain are doing it. The next thing you know, you find yourself in Jerusalem or in Israel for almost a year. And then somehow, what was the shift that had you go from this conventional law path to then volunteering in refugee camps and getting involved in human rights and basically taking the traditional law path and completely like reinventing it?
I would say it's pretty difficult to just pinpoint a very specific moment, just because I think it's more just putting together all the dots and connecting them. But I would say that I remember I did an internship in the National Commission of Energy in Spain, which it was something that our university, you need to do an internship. And they were like, oh, would you like to do this? I was like, well, sounds fine. And back then it was before the crisis, and they paid quite well. So I was like, okay, I'll get this. Like, it's a paid internship, government, probably not too much work. So I was like, yeah, I could do it. And I, so with my first paycheck, I was quite bored. So it was fine, but it wasn't much work. And I was just like checking algorithms for the electricity prices. So I was like, okay, I like algorithms. They're fun, but they don't really like keep me awake at night. So I found out about this organization that was organizing a trip to Tindouf, to Algeria, to the refugee camps. So that's where my first paycheck went, to buy a ticket on that plane to get to a military airport and go to Tindouf. So yeah, and I guess that wasn't perhaps the turning point, but it made me realize that I was quite happy in an office and I wasn't unhappy. I wasn't like having a bad time. I was having fun, like grabbing coffee at 11 o'clock every day. But then I went to the field and I was, wow, like I can't even remember like how many days passed, or like it was just a total different change of pace. So I decided that perhaps I wanted a job that allowed me precisely to have a little bit of office work and a little bit of that routine, but at the same time, okay, take your backpack and go and just get a tent and that's it. And it's you by yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I like how you're kind of looking at both models and then starting from that place of choosing of what do you want actually in it. And I'm curious what you saw when you were in some of these refugee camps, because I know for myself, I was actually in Israel maybe about a month ago. And being, you know, primarily based in the United States, you start to see a different world that you hear about out there, but then all of a sudden you suddenly find yourself immersed in it. And so I'm wondering if being in the camps and witnessing everything on the ground level, if that shifted anything in you and your directional path.
I think, yeah, being that and that experience had changed my vision of international justice quite a lot. And I saw there, at least in Algeria and in the case of Western Sahara, how powerful civil society can be and how powerful a population can be in organizing themselves without having a recognized government. But I think it's been more really throughout the years. Yeah, I've visited more refugee camps, and some are in better shape than others, and some have better conditions than others. And I must confess that I haven't seen by far the worst. I haven't. I've seen some of the Syrian refugee camps in Libya, where I work, where I was while I was on the ground in Libya. But those. That hasn't been the thing that has perhaps affected me the most. I remember that I did a trip, just a tourism trip with my parents when I was 18 to, must have been 18 or 19, to India. And I think that really affected me more in terms of, having that first contact with absolute poverty. And in fact, like I kept coming back to India the years after, and then I volunteered there when I was 19 or 20. And I got really obsessed with the history of India, and I got a scholarship then for going to Bangladesh and being on the ground doing microfinance. So I think really what really got me started on understanding more of what's going on when you get there was that like very inoffensive first trip with my parents to India, which was supposed to be a tourism trip, and I guess I saw it with very different eyes to perhaps other people see it when they're seeing the Taj Mahal, or I don't know, but that really, and then it's when actually came the trip to Western Sahara and the refugee camps. But like, if we go back more in time, that was, I would say, the first moment where I was like, wow.
Yeah.
There is another world there, and it's not pretty.
Yeah. It's it's interesting that you're highlighting that. I've got a good friend here who went to Nepal and had a similar eye-opening experience, thought he was going to go backpacking, and then saw all the malnutrition and ended up starting this whole company called Impossible to basically, you know, get to the core of that. And so I think for those that are listening, don't ever underestimate, you know, the moments of these seemingly random events or trips and travels and how they have such an impact. And so I'm curious, you know, eyewitness to atrocities, you know, you are one of the original team members of this company. And how did you make that shift from, you know, that moment, you know, when you're in India, then going on in these studies, these refugee camps, how did your direction start to pivot into this company?
I guess it's true that at the beginning of, I'm not sure if you call it my career, because these were like very short stints here and there with different organizations. I'm pretty much like just volunteering and seeing what I liked. But I went to, as I was mentioning before, I went to Bangladesh for a summer, and I tried to do microfinance there with Grameen Bank, which is a Nobel Peace Prize institution. And I enjoyed the work there, but I was, okay, development doesn't really grab me. So let's find something around this sector, because I know from an external person, everything may seem like the same thing, development, humanitarian action, international justice, but they're actually quite different. There are some overlaps. So I tried microfinance in Bangladesh, and then I was like, oh, this isn't really grabbing me. Let's try a little bit on the legal side, what I can do. And then it's when I went to Israel and did a little bit of civil rights. And then the Arab Spring started, and I happened to be in the Middle East. But it was a great place to be when you have revolutions around and you are interested in violence. So I started working for two professors at Tel Aviv University, precisely monitoring social media and the role in the revolutions. So it was quite timely. And at the moment, it seemed, to be honest, I just wanted to stay in Israel and to stay in the area, to stay in the Middle East. So I wanted to do something that could seem meaningful. So I was, well, this seems that it's going somewhere. So let's see how powerful can social media be in mobilizing people and organizing uprisings against dictators. So that really got me the bag of the Middle East, and getting the bag of the Middle East, it's I think it's a blessing and a curse, I guess. I know a lot of people who've been based there will tell you. So, but after I was there, and I got offered a fellowship to go to Cambodia to the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, and because I just had qualified as a lawyer, I actually want to say that I became a lawyer for doing something. And the only time I've been in court was in the case number 2 against 4 defendants who were accused of different war crimes and crimes against humanity. So it was the former leadership of the Khmer Rouge regime, which is quite cool. It's the only time I've been in court with the prosecution, like that time when we were prosecuting 4 Khmer Rouge leaders. So, but my point, what I was trying to say of that shift, is that I decided to come back to Europe. I went to The Hague, stayed at the International Criminal Court, and did some other legal work. And I thought, okay, I want to do this, but I think I need some field experience, because yes, prosecuting war crimes without actually seeing how and losing that connection from the ground doesn't seem right to me. I need to understand a little bit more what happens in these places. So I ended up in Libya, which was a very interesting experience, because Gaddafi, the revolution started in 2011. I got there in 2013, and the country was going into a civil war. So the security situation was bad. Everything was bad. So everything was complicated. Everything was like really out of my breath, out of my experience. But it taught me a lot. So that's how it started in the humanitarian field, mostly doing weapons control. And then when I came back, I got like still in the humanitarian sector, working on issues around security, because I had that background on high risk settings. So, and I had a job that allowed me to travel and to see how different humanitarian organizations work. But I guess it's a very interesting field, but it wasn't making me, let's say, tick. To me, the thing that drives me is that things that make me really upset and angry, and impunity for war crimes really upsets me to my limits. So I really wanted to go back to international justice and feel that I'm, I don't know, upset all the time about the crimes that are being committed or and that those crimes go unpunished. So I think that was the shift that I wasn't really, when I came and I joined Eyewitness, and I can tell you more about the project now, but when I came to Eyewitness, I wasn't at the beginning really looking for a job. It just happened that the person who trained me as a war crimes analyst said, well, I know about this project. They are looking for someone. It's kind of weird requirements. Like, what do you think? I was like, yeah, well, I definitely sounds good. And it sounds like a very weird project. So I wanted to know more about it. And then I remember I came to the interview, and it's a project of the International Bar Association. It started here, and now we are a separated NGO. And I remember coming to the interview to their offices, and I was like, this is a very fancy place for an NGO, because I've always worked in very horrible offices, like very low budget. So I was like, wow, I want to work here. So luckily, it turned out well for me, because I joined Eyewitness when it was a very small team. So it's been quite busy, but it's been great. And basically, what we are doing, we launch our app in June 2015, so it's been a few months already, and our application, which is available free to download on Android phone, basically what it does, it opens the sensors of the phone. So it acts like, it's like a normal camera. You can capture video and photo, but when you open it on safe mode, it starts expanding all the sensors of the phone. That captures all the metadata, and then when you send the material to us, we receive all like the photos, the videos with the metadata. We are allowed to verify it that way. And then we can also authenticate it, and we will seek which jurisdiction is the suitable one to seek accountability for those crimes. So our mandate is war crimes, crimes against humanity, torture, extrajudicial killings, anything that is under the umbrella of atrocity crimes. Which, as you may think, it's not much fun, and it's not a very fun topic, but it's true that the day to day, because we have to set up everything, it's quite interesting, mm-hmm. and it's always very varied, because we are in that intersection of, as you were saying at the beginning, public policy and law and technology, yeah. And we are basically a startup. So we are a startup. Because we have an app, we have a technology solution. It's just that we are trying to merge this idea of technology and channel the use of technology towards ending impunity for war crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think you've said a lot of different points that I want to touch back on in your story. And it sounds like you've always been this multi-passionate person, if you will, knowing that you love law, but you also loved being in the field. You loved being with the people, loved going to bat, even if it was that one time in court. And also, how do you merge these passions? And would you say that a lot of your journey has been kind of this discovery of, like, how do I take all these varying things that I love and enjoy about myself, and then how do I find the right vehicle or the model where I can encapsulate all of them? Would you say that kind of fits for you in some ways?
Yeah, totally. That totally resonates, because, and I will encourage anyone to try different things, and at least while you are young, because also each role has given me a different, totally different set of skills, but that they are very transferable. So when I've been on the ground, you have to build that patience. I've had coffee and tea in embassies of I don't know how many countries, of with people that don't even speak my language, and you somehow manage to communicate. So then would you just have to network after an event here in London with some other lawyers is like a piece of cake after that. So I know it may seem like, oh, like, and I think it gives you a little bit that mindset of being able to switch from one thing to another, and be comfortable and bring things from different fields. And to me, for example, this project, Eyewitness, it's a really good fit, because one of the advantages of being a startup and being in this original team is that you get to do a lot of things. And I think you get also that, from trying different things, you realize that in life you are never going to be just, okay, you may be a full-time lawyer, but you are never only going to be just with your nose on a book or just on your feet in front of the judge. You need to have different skill sets, and they will all come together. So I think it's good trying different things and different sectors and also travel and get to know people from different cultures. I think to me it has given me, I guess, a perhaps different way of working and approaching working life. And I say it a lot in London because having worked in the field before where you are on pretty much 6 days a week or like you and you hang out with the people you work with or coming from that, then you come to London and you have to reshuffle your routine and okay, and now maybe I have a personal life, I have a professional life, and I have to make this work. It's like, why don't you, we just merge everything together? So I guess, yeah, like it totally resonated with me, like what you were saying before of it's trying new things. And I think each experience gives you a different thing that will come handy at some stage in your life. So even like, I mean, I've waited tables. I've been a waiter for such a long time, like being into human rights at the beginning of my career, you are a waiter as well. I was doing night shifts for a while. I've even worked at a yoga studio a few nights a week just to make a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And, you know, I love that you're sharing that. And one of the other points, too, is you being, you know, a 29-year-old woman going into this arena. And some people might be listening and being like, war crimes, really? Like, that's what like lights you up. And I think it's like one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is that for those that are listening, it doesn't matter where your passion falls, whether it is in war crimes, and what motivates you is when you see injustice and you feel anger from it. Like whatever that thing that burns inside of you, that fuels inside of you, leaning into that first and foremost, and especially as being a woman going into this, some might be listening like, is she crazy, like going into these areas? And I love like your relentless ability to just go. Doesn't matter what anything about you, you're just relentless passion. And so that's just something I wanted to touch on in your stories.
That's kind of true. And I remember when I got back from Libya, I took a week off because I just needed it, and it was my birthday. I was like, what am I going to do now? So I took a week off, and then I started sending emails. And within a week, I had a lot of interviews. And I think it was because a lot of people were like, a woman going into a war zone like Libya now? Like, I was like, she must be crazy. Let's give her an interview. So I think, I mean, and I'm not recommending doing a crazy thing just for getting an interview. It worked out in my way, but in my case, it worked out, but and totally. But I think what you were saying about passion, that's totally true. And I do, the thing is that I see it quite normal because I'm super lucky and I'm really privileged to work with people that really love what they are doing and that really are giving more than 100% of themselves. And not even as lawyers or human rights or as war crimes investigators, but also in their fields. So I have friends who are social entrepreneurs. I have friends that are humanitarian workers. I have friends who are like corporate lawyers and they are happy with it. So I say, it's very important to love what you do, but I think it's almost more important that whatever you do, like whatever you are trying to solve, really makes you upset and angry and keeps you going. Because yeah, I do love a lot of things, you know. I mean, I'm from Spain. We are passionate people by nature. We love things. Well, like to me, I love everything or I hate it, but there is no gray area. So I could do 1,000 things. So I've decided to do the thing that makes me angry the most. And I think if for you love works, that's fine. But if it works better being upset, and for me it does, like I'd rather choose being an upset person because that that may end in paternity one day, hopefully.
Yeah, amazing. I love that you're highlighting that, because sometimes you think it has to be this like lovey, just, you know, beautiful, positive, enlightening place that fuels your drive. And I think it can come from anywhere. And if you're willing to tap into whatever that thing is, whether it's the thing that makes you the most angry or the thing that lights you up the most, it all fuels and it's amazing. So, you know, in line with that, let's go back to eyewitness for a moment. And I know, you know, you've been in this, like you said, the thing that makes you the most angry. Let's talk about war crimes. So what do you think is the biggest challenge in investigating these war crimes? Because I know for some people listening, they're hearing these like multi-dimension sides of you sharing. But then at the end of the day, I'm personally curious about these war crimes. So tell us a little bit, you know, about that.
Well, on my experience, and I mean, obviously there are war crimes investigators, analysts, and lawyers that are more qualified to talk about this than me. There are so many challenges. So you have on one side the political challenges that we will need an entire podcast or a series of podcasts for talking about the political challenges of prosecuting war crimes, because it's a highly politicized field of work. But then you have the legal challenges. So let's say those are total different set of challenges. And when you are on the ground, like, and people generally ask me, like, but these things like take so long. Like, I was in Cambodia working, trying to prosecute war crimes that happened before I was born, that happened in 1975. Like, I mean, I wasn't even a thought on my mother's mind. So it's it's crazy. So what I'm trying to say here is that why do they take so long? It's because these investigations are highly complicated. So, and it's a very modern field of work. International justice and international tribunals only were born in the second half of the 20th century. So the international rule of law is such a baby, if you put it in perspective with our legal systems, with the legal system you may have in the US or in Europe. So the challenges you face from that point of view, there are so many. And when you are in terms of investigations, for example, just the security situation or sending teams of investigators to the ground, capturing evidence, and something that I was doing work on before joining Eyewitness is those NGOs and those civil society groups that are on the ground in an armed conflict, and they have access to that information that captures that an abuse or a violation of international law has happened. And they are the ones that are there, and they are the ones that, if that information is not captured, in a lot of cases, that information will disappear and will never see a courtroom. So I was looking at the power of civil society, and mostly because as a humanitarian worker, I've seen it on the ground that you may be the last one living and you are witnessing these abuses. And to me, it was really resonating on my mind, like, what is the moral duty as a humanitarian worker witnessing all this? You have a specific mandate, which is providing aid, but on the other hand, wow, like, you have access to, you could be documenting things that that could be very powerful in a courtroom. So it's definitely, and I don't want to advocate at all, because like humanitarians, they have a very specific mandate that keeps them alive and keeps them access to areas that are very in need. But like, that's why, how it started to me, the idea of like, okay, so it's like empowering civil society or empowering other citizens that are in this group. So if you put it together, what I was talking about, social media and revolutions, so this is pretty much what Eyewitness is doing. It's just giving, just to use a very catchy line, power to the people. It's just all these NGOs on the ground documenting international law violations. Now you have a tool that allows you to capture vast amounts of materials, transfer this material in a secure way to a server that we host, and to a server that is secure and that we maintain with the help of LexisNexis for bringing these cases forward. So I think we are solving here, and going back to your question, we are solving here one of the many challenges of war crimes investigations. And technology is not going to be the panacea, it's not going to be the solution, and it's never going to replace exhumating mass graves, or is never going to replace taking witness statements, but it can help all this material that you perhaps see on social media that doesn't meet the legal standards and that's not admissible in court. So it can help with this kind of things that it's perhaps what we are seeing nowadays. It's an overflow of material. For example, if you look at Syria, you have over 4 million videos on YouTube, 4 million videos. So if the commission that is investigating Syria and the abuses in Syria has to watch 4 million videos and verify them for possible violations and that they happen in Syria and that they are not a fake and it's not Syrian hero boy of a film crew in Malta. And I don't know if you watched that video, but otherwise Google it, Syrian hero boy. It was a film crew in Malta. So you have a lot of fake videos coming from conflict areas. So eyewitness can help with this. And it was indeed like how it was born. It's an idea of the executive director of the International Bar Association, Mark Ellis, in response of all this material that was coming out from social media, because he was often asked to comment on videos, and he was, well, the conduct may be a violation of international law. It looks like an armed conflict situation, but really I have no tools to verify that this is not a fake video, for example, yeah. or that the content has been altered. So we can help with that. And given that perhaps the legal sector one day has to modernize itself and look at different kinds of evidence and like accept technology as well, this could be, I think there's great potential for our application and our solution to help any impunity for war crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And so for those that are listening that want to check out Eyewitness and want to get the app, how do they go about doing that?
So you can go to our website, which is www.eyewitnessproject.org, and there is a video there and there's more information. And you'll be able also to see frequently asked questions and a little bit more of background on the project. Or you can go to the Google Play Store, and it's called Eyewitness to Atrocities. And you can download it from the Google Play Store. So that's available. It's free to download. I must say that, yeah, our mandate is trying to prosecute war crimes, crimes against humanity, or other crimes that happen in conflict areas. So, because a lot of people think that can be a good tool for example, police brutality with the incidents you had last year in the States. Mm-hmm. There are perhaps other apps that are better suitable for us, also because our project, what makes it different is that we have a legal team. That's my responsibility. So that's me. So we do have a legal team, and I'm part of that legal team. Reviewing all that material and trying to seek accountability. So that's what makes us special, that we have not only an app, but we have a back end, the back end of the project is that material is actually being acted upon, whatever we see.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, amazing work. So let's transition to the last part of the show, which is our rapid fire round. And for those that are listening, Raquel has got an amazing giveaway she's going to share about at the end of the round. So make sure you stay tuned. So rapid fire round, 5 random questions that you have no idea I'm going to ask you. Are you ready? God.
No, I don't think I'm ready, but let's go. Let's go for it.
Okay. Question number 1, what is the biggest obstacle you have had to overcome as a woman in the line of work that you're doing?
I think as a woman is perhaps proving yourself. I guess in this sector, perhaps you have to prove yourself every day, but as a woman, it's international humanitarian law is a very military-driven, or well, not military-driven, but it's a sector where there is a lot of people with military backgrounds, security, humanitarian work as well. So biggest challenge is navigating those gender dynamics, not only in the professional arena, but also at the personal level, and more what I was saying before, when your professional personal life is kind of intertwine in field missions. All those gender dynamics and the military and civilian persons, and you're a woman, it's kind of a mess. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, next question. What is one thing that you do daily that you feel contributes to your personal success?
That I do daily. I try to exercise daily. Well, daily is a little bit of a stretch, but I do think maybe you were hoping for something more intellectual, but I have quite a lot of energy. If I have one coffee that is not decaf, I may not sleep. So I had a lot of insomnia problems. So generally, working out, whether it's yoga, running, or just like walking for a long time, kind of helps. So I do say I'm a huge fan of working out for success.
Awesome. Okay, next question. What is one thing that someone has told you and you feel was like the worst advice you've ever received?
Probably my dad. So, I hope he won't listen to this, but I remember when I was, I received a message from the Spanish embassy in Libya asking about my whereabouts, because they were, the situation was really bad security-wise, and the commercial flights were going to stop. So they were like, well, we're giving the possibility of people to pull out now. What do you think? And I remember talking to my dad, and he was, maybe you just have to get used to it. I was like, I think that's what's wrong with everything, that you just have to get used to a civil war. So, I mean, and I was lucky because I was able to get out on a plane, but like other people are not, obviously. But I think that was, if I had followed that advice, I don't know where I would be right now, because the situation wasn't good. So I think, what I'm trying to say here with that example is that sometimes you know your limits, and sometimes you know when you have to plug, take the plug out, and you know how you have to, I wouldn't say give up, but like move on.
Yeah.
I love so, it. So yeah, that was a little bit of bad advice of like, maybe you just have to stay and like get used to it. Like people got used to violence in the Basque Country. I was like, I don't think it's the same, Dad.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Next question. If there is something you could say now to your 20-year-old self in just a few words, what would you say to her?
You'll be fine. just have more patience. And I think that's fine. It's fine to take time. And I haven't learned that lesson yet, to be honest. I'm not a very patient person. And I think that's perhaps what has driven me forward and to keep doing things, because I don't want to wait to other people to try to solve problems. I don't want to wait for that. So I'll go and do it. So being a little bit impatient is good, but sometimes you just need to build on, like, just wait a little and see how things play out. So that's what I would say to myself. You just don't need to go and grab absolutely everything that comes your way.
Yeah, awesome. And last question, what does living an unconventional life mean to you?
Oh, I guess you should ask this to my friends, because they are the ones who think it's unconventional. As I said, like, to me, I do feel pretty conventional. I come to an office. Sometimes I travel.
to refugee camps and other places.
But I guess, to me, living an unconventional life feels pretty normal, because I don't know it other way. So this is more, I mean, it's pretty bad manners giving this to the audience, but it would be, to me, it's what fulfills me. But I didn't get into this by thinking I want something not conventional. I just thought, what is what I want? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe it turned out to be an unconventional life, but I never thought, oh, I don't want a normal life. I've never thought that. I was just like, this is what interests me. And then maybe it happened not to be very conventional.
Yeah, awesome. I love it. Well, Raquel Vasquez, everyone. So tell us a little bit about this gift that you have for our listeners, which is amazing for all of those that are interested in going international.
Well, so what we are giving away today is 1 hour of my time. I talk a lot, so it may be more than 1 hour, but I will say to discuss international career opportunities or public service opportunities or any kind of career in an international NGO or international organization. I can help you out wherever you are. Tailoring your CV or your cover letter. And this is generally quite boring. So I hope the audience really appreciates it. Yeah. Or like, depends, like if someone is, I'm happy to discuss whatever the winner is, like which kind of different options she or he is looking at, or if he or she just has like a vague idea, perhaps brainstorming some ideas of how to channel what makes that person upset.
Yeah, amazing. I love it. Well, for those that are listening, you can head over to unconventionallifeshow.com to go and enter yourself for that amazing hour-long giveaway, and make sure you leave a review or subscribe to this podcast in order to be a valid entry. So thank you so much, Raquel, for your time, for tuning in from London. Unconventional Life listeners, another great episode. We will talk to you all next time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
If you would like to win this week's prize giveaway from our show guests featuring free access to their online courses, books, and other impactful tools to help you on the path to living an unconventional life, simply subscribe to the podcast on iTunes now and go to unconventionallifeshow.com to let us know you did. You can also get a second entry by leaving us an iTunes review.